This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
Golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and we are going to discuss the evolution of the special effects from the original cast movies, the Next Generation movies, and the Kelvin timeline movies this week on Standard Orbit. And, you know, as movies age, practical effects hold up better than CGI, you know, these are all discussions that fans have, that movie fans in general, especially Star Trek fans, because we love minutiae as Star Trek fans. We love to discuss every last thing. It's not enough to talk about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. You have to talk about the Mutara Nebula and how it looked and all that stuff. So, so this week we're talking about how the high-tech effects hold up, you know, over all these years, because Star Trek movies has been, gosh, was it 40 years now, almost, Ken? Let's see, 1979, almost.
Yeah,
we're closing
I guess it's
in.
Getting
we're closing
there.
In
it's
on
getting
40
there.
Years, huh?
Yeah, it is. You know, this, Zach, we're geeking out, right? This is the ultimate geek out. I was thinking in my head, you know the song Freak Out from the 70s?
Freak
Somebody,
Out!
Yeah, somebody's got to do a geek out parody of that.
Geek
Maybe
out.
We can get Matt Rushing to do it or something. He loves to sing. But, you know, Star Trek has always been substance over style, for the most part, especially with the original series television show and then with The Next Generation to a degree. I mean, the effects were much better, don't get me wrong, but a lot of the sets and things like that still, you know, had a lot to be desired, let's put it that way. What I really loved about the movie, starting out with the motion picture and the effects, is like, wow, when you can add a lot of money to a budget and you can really play with things and you can make it as big as Star Wars. You know, that was the effort. I wouldn't say they got there, but it really is exciting. And I love having these discussions because, you know, like I said, we always talk, oh, it's the story. And they're right. But man, if it can be aesthetically pleasing or it can blow your mind with some really cool effects at the same time as having a good story, oh, that's the cake and eating it too. So let's start off with the motion picture and the effects, and the effects show that it was, and how it holds up today.
Well, with the motion picture, there is no comparison, right, Ken?
Cheers to you, my friend.
Yeah, this is what brought Star Trek into, I don't know, the modern special effects era. Because if you look at what's interesting to me is if you look at Star Trek, the original series, it ran from 1966 to 1969, as we all know. But during that time, you know, 2001, A Space Odyssey came out in 1968, right? So you're telling me, you know, if you've seen 2001, you know what I'm talking about. Special effects are excellent. They hold up, you know, to this day. And you think, wow, this was going on at the same time as the original series? I mean, I understand that was a big budget film, but still, I mean, like, it's just night and day. Like that stuff looks like it could have been from the late 80s. It's so great. So, you know, Star Trek The Motion Picture is finally them getting up to speed with special effects, having the budget to do it, not having to rely on stock footage and, you know, slapdash, you know, blue screen and compositing and stuff. And you could really get a texture and a feel for the entire universe of Star Trek. And, you know, people say it's boring. People say they spend too much time on beauty shots of things. There are things to be said there for pacing. Sure, I get what they're saying. But, they wanted to show off all the hard work they put into it. Is that right or wrong? I don't know. But hey, it's more Star Trek for us to watch because, you know, 10 years after Turnabout Intruder was Star Trek The Motion Picture, you hadn't seen these guys or these ships or anything like that in 10 years, and you certainly hadn't seen them in high definition, right? I mean, even watching like broadcast tapes reruns of the last 10 years or so. So just, I mean, I don't appreciate it. I'm too young to. I grew up with the next generation. So to me, all these things are at my disposal at all times. So just in general, you got to look at the motion picture from its historical standpoint and understand why the special effects were such a big part of them, because that was a big selling point. Like you said, they wanted to live up to Star Wars. They're doing all these impressive shots. And I think the special effects are great. You know, I mean, they really hold up to this day. The compositing looks great. The Enterprise never looked better than it did in the motion picture, because the ILM knew how to light it correctly, and they spent a lot of time and detail making sure everything looked ace, because this was its first impression. You know, I think, you know, as the budgets got cut, as the movies continued, we'll talk about that, but, you know, the ship never looked quite as elegant as it did in the motion picture, and it looked excellent.
Well, I'll make one correction there. It wasn't ILM that did the special effects for the motion picture. Now, I'm trying to remember the guy's name, Doug.
Oh, is it John Dykstra?
John Dykstra, yeah.
Okay.
He came in. Actually, there was a special effects house that was working on it, and they completely screwed everything up. And that's why there was so much rushing around. There were three or four different effects companies. And I remember the story of the producers and the director, everybody just running around from house to house to house to get everything edited as it was coming in, because the original effects company just couldn't pull it off. And they spent all this money on it, and it just came out magnificent, right? So Tony Black was talking about in the Babel conference, the Spock walkthrough with V'ger. You know, he thought he had it. Tim Hans talks about the Enterprise and the wormhole. I mean, the warp effect in that movie is still the best.
Mm-hmm. Right? The rainbow effect, yeah.
That rainbow effect with the explosion, everything about that was incredible. The Vulcan shuttle and it's flipping around, or, you know, and if we circle back to what Tim was saying about the wormhole, you can't beat that. It was just wild. And what's interesting to me is when I look back on it today, and I know I have to kind of take my appreciation for it out and kind of be a little bit more neutral, right, when I'm watching it. The special effects still work. They really do. And I know when they did the director's upgrade or the director's cut in 2000, boy, I wish they would put that on Blu-ray, it only enhanced it even more. So just the little more combination with that CGA brought it to a whole next level. And as we move into the rest of the movies, right, because there was some talk about how the ship looked in Star Trek II coming out of the space dock, and it's like, that's the same scenes.
Yeah.
Right? Well, they just cut and paste it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you bring up the director's edition, and I think overall the director's edition is a huge improvement. Just pacing, special effects wise, there were some things they just could not accomplish at the time. Obviously, Vulcan had a moon, so it's not supposed to have. They fixed that. they added some cool stuff in San Francisco. Opened up Starfleet headquarters some. You got to see some alternate shots of the Enterprise that never were completed in time, because, you know, Star Trek motion picture was against the clock, you know, run against the clock. It's the best kind of director's cut. You know, it's not like Star Wars special edition where things are just changed and you're asking yourself, why did you do this? You know, like, you understand all the changes they made, and I think, you know, there are a few shots that maybe are questionable, and they remain questionable in both versions. Like, if we're talking about what holds up, what doesn't, right? I think overall we agree everything looks excellent overall. But then, you know, sometimes, you know, things slip through. You know, you're on a budget, you're on a time constraint. You know, you just got to get stuff done and move on. When the crew gets out on the saucer section, starts walking on the saucer section, that shot always looked very odd to me.
Yes, it didn't play well until the director's cut. You're right.
Yeah, and then they did fix it in the director's cut, but even then in the director's cut, there are a couple angles where it's like clearly CGI, and it's like, I don't know. That's a tough one to construct, though. You know, that's a tough one. But, you know, to me, that those you ask what holds up, what doesn't. That's really the only stuff that doesn't really hold up to me. And then, you know, if you look at how many special effects are in this movie, that's a strong testament to, you know, inside the V'ger, like you said, the guys in the Babel concert were talking about, that's a whole nother world in there. And you want it, like, when Spock's flying by, like, whoa, what did you just fly by? That looked cool down there. You know, it's just, there's so much stuff in there. It just opens up your imagination to what is all in this giant cloud. And that's great. It's a lot of those special effects are suggestive. You know, you're like, what's behind this door or this or that? And just great stuff, you know, and it still holds up to this day. So,
I agree. And, you know, Christopher Baca, and I agree, he left a pretty long note in the thread in the Babel conference. I was reading, I was like, oh my God, we could just use this as our script. And, you know, truth be told, I did write the script before this came out, Christopher, but I think I was aligned on most everything you wrote here. But there's one piece where he talks about the Enterprise flying through the light effect during the V'ger transformation, and he's spot on. To me, there isn't a prettier shot yet in all the movies through the new ones that really match that. I don't know why that is, but maybe it's the Earth below, the light effect, and then, you know, the Enterprise just looking as gorgeous as it ever did. And they use that shot as well in the Wrath of Khan. Yeah, and it still plays up well. And it's funny because I was reading what Lee Hutchinson was writing about how he still gets goosebumps seeing the model come out of dry dock with the rousing Horner score in cinema, right? And I okay, Lee, I do respect your opinion, but I'm sorry, man. Goldsmith score just kills it when it's coming out of dry dock. So we'll arm wrestle on that one when I'm over in the UK one of these days. But it's still, I get what you're saying. There are certain things, or certain music, or certain that gives you those goosebumps and gets you all excited. So now that I've kind of gone into the Wrath of Khan, let's kind of lump in. I think it's fair to do the Wrath of Khan and Star Trek III, which we've talked a lot about on this show. But when we talk about the special effects,
ILM did take over at this point.
That's correct. Okay. That's where ILM took over for the next three movies. They did 2, 3, and 4. I thought they did a brilliant job. Of course, they didn't have the funds that they had for the motion picture. It was really scaled back. However, they also didn't have to develop and create the Enterprise again, mm-hmm. and they hated that model. I remember them saying, and they actually painted it right so that it wouldn't have all the things that we really liked about it being reflective, but
yeah,
they made it
the
so that they could
all
use
that
it.
Stuff. It kind of made it more dull gray color.
Right, so that they could film it a little bit easier and they wouldn't have to take so long for setup and get things just right. So there was some give and take, and you can tell that. But what they really did a nice job was, I don't know, it's kind of an oxymoron here. They did a nice job roughing up the ship, even though yeah. I wasn't happy that they were roughing up the ship. They really did. It looked good. I mean, it's battle damage, it's scars. Everything through the Mataara Nebula, I thought, were really good effects.
Yeah, and the Mataara Nebula, they reused that thing for years. They used it in Next Generation, The Best of Both Worlds. Yep. Used it in Deep Space Nine, many times in Deep Space Nine, actually. And you think they would have, like, I don't know, recolored it or something when they used it on television, but they don't. It's just, oh, there it is, blue and purple and pink. Like, there's the Mataara Nebula. But, yeah, that's – and today that would all be CGI, right? But back then they created, like, clouds of liquid and tanks and filmed it and composited, and it's just like there's just something more,
it
just something, you know, real about that, and your eye realizes that it's real, and stuff, yeah, and stuff works. And then, you know, talking about special effects in the Wrath of Khan, this was the first fully CGI sequence in a film, the Genesis,
that's correct,
effect, the demonstration tape, you know, which mm-hmm. is like, you know, you watch it when I was younger, I was like, oh cool, it's a planet, but I was like, oh wow, that's CGI. Like in 1982? Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. They did a hell of a job with that. They really did. It still holds up pretty well, I think, as a demonstration. But, yeah, flying through the mountains and zooming through, that was great. I mean, it was you think about Star Wars through the Death Star, and that was all practically shot, right? They pulled the camera right into these valleys and
yeah,
alleys
giant,
and troughs and things.
Construction of the trench, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what, you know, you can see how from when Star Wars was made to the time they did that for Star Trek II, how that technology could really be a big difference maker. I don't know if I appreciated it as much back then. I thought it was cool. But as time has gone on, I was like, man, you know, that still tells the story just fine. It doesn't pull you out. It looks pretty good. I would say the screen around it looks worse when they do the close-up on it.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the latest Star Trek II Blu-ray, and I know they touched up even some more things, so maybe they worked on that a little bit.
No, it's pretty much the same.
Is it?
It's just the director's cut in HD. I own it and I've watched it. You know, it's interesting. The color timing is something that's actually very different, and I actually prefer the more bluish tint that a lot of things have these days. I know a lot of people don't. A lot of people complain that, oh, you're taking all the color out of things, and to me, like, if you look at you know, if you go look at the theatrical version of The Wrath of Khan and then the director's cut, like director's cut's a little bluer, so people aren't a fan of that. Like, it's a lot of movies today when they get remastered, they get a little bluer. I know when they released The Terminator on Blu-ray, they gave it this blue tint that Terminator 2 has, but the original Terminator did not have. Similarly, when they redid the Superman 2, they made the Richard Donner cut. It's all a little bluer, a little whiter. I'm getting all like into geek out, right? But Ken is pumping his fist.
That's right, baby. Dance to it.
I think I like the bluer look. And, you know, and this kind of compares, you can compare this to, if you go look at the same exact scene you were talking about of the Enterprise coming out of dry dock and the motion picture and then Wrath of Khan, the color timing is different. So but it actually helps. It blends with the film around it better. It's not like they just cut and paste it. They actually color treated it so it actually matched everything a little better. Looks different. But to me, when things look yellow or brown and have more earthy tones, I feel like it looks a little bit dingy, you know. Mm-hmm. And I like the cleaner, whiter, bluer look that you know, remastering of images that films that have been going on and recently. So that's just my take on it. I like that. I know it's not for everybody. And then especially, you know, going back to the Star Wars specialist and thing, oh, I grew up watching it this way and now you changed it. Ah, but I mean, really just, that's not a deal breaker, people. But
no, I know a lot of people do get upset over those types of things. Not for me. I mean, I'm one of those guys that's like, if Paramount came up with the money, and Lord knows they don't have any money right now, come on, CBS, let's get merged. and they went back and they really upgraded the films, and they wouldn't need to do a lot of work with these Star Trek movies. They really wouldn't.
The main thing they have to do is compositing. Because I believe, was it Christopher Bakke on the Babel Conference who mentioned the compositing? I know he had a lot to say, but I know I recognize he was talking about someone. I believe it was him. Talking about Star Trek 3 and the compositing. And I agree. Yeah. The stealing the Enterprise is, you know, one of my favorite moments in the films and Star Trek in general. Yep. As well. But you can really tell the compositing there. Because I was looking for a cool Twitter background image, you know. And actually, right now, it's the shot of the Enterprise from motion picture we were just talking about, where after it comes out of the explosion, the Viger explosion, it's over Earth. And originally, I was going to get the Enterprise, stealing the Enterprise from Space Dock, Star Trek 3. But I looked at the, you know, the HD images they have on like TrekCore and stuff, and the compositing is just too rough. Like, you see the matte lines around it. You see, like, you know, little like, oh, that one's cut a little too closely. That's what they, I mean, look, the models themselves, the way they move, the way they're lit, that's not the problem. The problem is putting all the pieces together. That's the problem. And so, to me, like, if they could just, like, recomposite everything, that would be excellent. And that's what they did on the Star Wars special editions. I know those movies get a lot of crap, the special editions, but there was a lot of good done there. They cleaned up the image. They cleaned up the matte boxes and matte lines. You know, everything just fits together a lot better because you don't see the seams as much anymore in the special effects. And that's what's the problem with these early Star Trek movies, is you see the seams. You know, you see the seams of when they're like, oh, well, obviously this is matted over this layer and all that. So if you're watching it on a big screen TV in HD, you're gonna see those inconsistencies, unfortunately. So to me, that's the one thing that doesn't hold up in all these movies, and not in every scene. Okay, it's not like it's distracting every scene, but there's certain scenes where you're like, yeah, I can definitely see where that's not quite. When I was watching in my VHS tape on my, you know, 20 inch TV when I was a kid, didn't quite see those problems, but now I do.
Yeah, so you know, if you were to give Star Trek 2 and you gave Nick Meyer some money, he would definitely redo the Genesis planet. Right, the inside the tunnel shot.
Oh, the cave. Yeah, that's little. Yeah,
he hated that when it was done, when it was made. They just like, nah, it just didn't work the way I wanted, and it just didn't come out right. And you know, that's a tough thing to do. You know, for its time and whatnot, I thought it was okay. But yeah,
well, that and then I don't hear a lot of people talk about this as much as the Genesis cave, but City Alpha 5, the outside of it, like when they're walking around in the sandstorm, like it's like you can tell that they had some like overlay of, you know, some, I'm not sure how they did it, but it's like, that's not a sandstorm, guys. That's like a cloud you put over the lens.
Well, you know, no, they really did. They had these engines going and blowing that sand all over the place. And there's pictures of them all wearing the masks and things and glasses and goggles because the sand was blowing like crazy. And those costumes or the uniforms that Chekhov Terrell were wearing were perfect for protecting them, but they just couldn't breathe. So, I mean, it was like one of the, okay, their eyes were fine, their ears were fine, they weren't getting covered with sand, they just didn't have any oxygen. So gotcha. Other than that little thing, I hear what you're saying, but you'll see bits and pieces, but that would have been a lot safer and cleaner and probably more sexier in CGI. But
they could have gone on location if they would have had a bigger budget, you know, gone out to the desert. Could have gone out down the street to the Vasquez Rocks.
Yeah, no one would have been like, hey, we don't recognize that spot.
Right. Yeah, it's Vulcan. Yeah. That's every planet we ever see. Right. And then, you know, talk about reusing things. The spacesuits they have are the same ones that Kirk and Spock wore in the motion picture. Or at least the one that Spock wears, the one that Kirk wears, because there were like reshoots. Because originally in motion picture, there was like a whole memory wall sequence. There's all this crazy behind the scenes stuff about the motion picture footage that we've still never seen. This continuity problem exists. It might be in the special longer version of the motion picture, but you see Kirk in two different versions of the spacesuit, one for the original version and one for the reshoots. And I think that's been corrected in the director's edition, if I'm not wrong.
No, you're right. And it's funny, in the extended edition, they actually show Kirk leaving the Enterprise, and you can see the wall of the studio in the background. It was really odd that they put that in there, and it's like, what, you don't think people would notice that? You know, I
mean, yeah, the Star Trek fans are going to notice that. Just put it on there.
it was just a weird thing, but you know, it's so if we circle back here, so for Star Trek II, I think overall the special effects overall hold up pretty well. It's not a movie that pulls you up. I don't think they had the money. They took the glossiness off the ship, like we were saying. Mm-hmm. The Genesis Cave, Mutara Nebula, though, looked phenomenal. Mm-hmm. The battle scene, I think, still holds up pretty well.
No Reliance is a great model. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a very good model. The whole battle in the nebula was good. In Star Trek III, as you were saying, the only thing that was kind of weird was the view screen at the beginning. I don't know what that was, but it's like instead of using a green screen, they just put up something like a up against the window there, and it looks like they hung little shiny objects or something.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's similar to what they did in the observation lounge on Next Generation. Yeah. The sequence.
Only they did it a lot better in Next Generation. Yes, they did it a lot better in Next Generation. People ask me. But anyway, yeah. And I thought that, that was the first time we saw the Bird of Prey. I thought it was a brilliant looking ship. It had a lot of motion to it. The Excelsior, we talked about, what Chris said and what you're saying, I absolutely agree with. You know, inside the space station, it looked a little odd, but once they left that, perfect. And the destruction of the Enterprise was phenomenal.
Amazing, yeah.
It was phenomenal. I would say one of the things that was pointed out by Adam Ridgewell was the model work in Star Trek III was pretty awesome, and we were just talking about that. The only thing that was missed, because he put a picture in there, was the scale of the Enterprise versus the scale of the Bird of Prey. When I was watching that movie for the first time, until they asked what the complement of the ship was, and it turned out to be a dozen, I thought it was
Same size. A
capital ship. You know, a good, maybe not as big as the Enterprise, but still a capital ship, meaning, you know, a decent size, kind of like the D7, Katinga, whatever you want to call it, or both, or one or the other, but a big ship. And then, you know, because of some of the model shots, you would get that impression. But otherwise, I thought Star Trek III pretty much holds up well. The effects, of it landing on Vulcan were pretty cool for its day. Mm-hmm. And
it's the first time we've seen something like that in Star Trek. You know, ship landing, it's a big deal.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I think it was shot at the campus. Was it UCLA or was some college in LA? But they did a really nice job, I thought, of folding in the backdrop of Vulcan and climbing those stairs. I mean, it doesn't look like as believable as, you know, but it's there. It's enough to pull you into the story and not pull you out. So I thought they did well there. Mm-hmm. And let's swing it a little bit to the Voyage Home, because here we had some very unique special effects, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, with the time travel was a very, very interesting approach. I mean, it's very psychedelic. Is that a good description? I mean,
that's a very good thing. Brent Williams kind of says that, you know, always enjoyed the time travel, floating head, echoes of the future.
It was cool, though. It was very high concept. You know, I mean, we'd seen the crew travel in time back and forth all the time, but like they had some budget this time, and I'm not sure who came up with this, but like the whole reeds in the water and the heads coming out and the quotes from the characters that are from later in the film, because, you know, time travel. Very interesting approach, and something you'd see kind of like an art house film or something, you know, not so much a Star Trek film. But that's the thing about Star Trek IV. They tried a lot of things. They had a different score. They had a different approach to things. They had a more comedic tone, because the last two films have been so heavy on, you know, tragedy and death and life and no villain as well. So it all... The differences in the approach here is across the board for Star Trek IV, as opposed to just making another Star Trek movie. They made something unique.
Yeah, they did. They did. And I thought they did a great job. One of the things that fooled me completely was the model work with the whales.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you think... I always thought those are real whales, right?
Yeah. I guess there were only two shots, you know, with them breaching, mm-hmm. that were taking out of the ocean. And you can tell the difference, but all the underwater scenes... were robotics, little miniature robotics.
Yeah, either larger puppets, like for when in front of the bird of prey, or when, you know, they're in the tanks, you see little, like you said, like little, probably what, 3 feet or something like that.
I've actually seen them. Yeah, I saw when I was in San Diego one time. They had the Star Trek exposition, that traveling exposition, and they had those models there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't even know if they were 3 feet, to be honest with you. They were pretty small, but, you know, phenomenal work there. And I thought, you know, genius, because I said, well, you know, I've seen enough Jacques Cousteau to think that it wouldn't be that hard to dive into the ocean and pull some of those shots, because you've seen whales swimming off in the distance before.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not like something we hadn't
seen. Well, you can get the shots you need, so.
yeah, they're pretty good. They're pretty good. So you were talking about, hey, the whales are cool, you know, come down and film me. Funny story. So I hope the listeners here just appreciate this for a second. So 17 years old, I'm in high school. I think it was my last summer at high school. And I'm down off Provincetown, Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And I'm out with my friend and his dad and his brother. And we were fishing for bluefish on a 16-foot Glastron boat. And it was nighttime. It was just twilight, but it was more nighttime. And a whale surfaced probably 100 yards away from us. And we radioed in that there's a whale up here. And this person, his uncle, his cousin, whatever, is back at the beach house, is saying, okay, you better move. So we started railing in the lines. And this thing breached right next to us. I mean, scared the heck. We had the spotlight on it. You could see its face go right by us. My best friend, his name was also Ken, was at the helm of the helm of the boat. He just guns it, right? The rigs go over the side. We go flying.
Oh, whoa.
Right? And it's like, Ken, calm down. You got to slow down. We're getting tossed all over the place. Right. Finally calms down. We get our stuff together. We come in, and there's people waiting for us on the beach, right? Oh, you saw our whales. That's incredible. So me, just like you, oh, whales are chill, whatever. I mean, I was spooked, but I wasn't that afraid. As we beached the boat and we started getting off the bow, I was like, Ken, are you okay? He's like, yeah. And his older brother, Lenny, he was, I don't know, 10 years older than us or whatever, a lot bigger than I was. We're getting off the boat. He's like, Ken, you okay? And I said, hey, Ken, you had nothing to worry about. Even if we got knocked over, whales don't eat people, right? His brother started pounding the living crap out of me on the beach. I mean, full front punches. He's like, whales don't read encyclopedias. Bap! What are you going to say when you're in its mouth? Wham! You know, all the way up the beach. So I'll always think of that now when you say, hey, the whales are cool. They're
whales are chill, man.
Yeah, well, not to Lenny. Wow. So anyway, sorry. At this side, you might appreciate that story.
Now for that, that's good. I'll keep that in mind, that the whales do not read encyclopedia.
Yeah, none of the animal and none of the animals that supposedly don't eat you. Oh. Yes, I'll never forget that line as long as I live. Anyway, so the voyage home, the spin around back around the sun was fine. The crash of the bird of prey into San Francisco Harbor. You know, look,
there
it's heading for the bridge.
Classic those are great shorthand. Scenes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. You don't know what they're looking at or what's going on. But anyway. So.
Though I liked all the evaporation of Earth's oceans. That was an interesting.
That was very
fact.
Well
I'm not
done.
Sure how they did that. Actually, probably having something to do with salt. Usually in movies where they have to have like water like that, they pour salt and they film it upside down. That's probably what they did, but I thought it was a very effective special effect. And of course, we had the whale probe.
Yeah, he was cool. Very well done, by the way.
Thank you, thank you. I'm like the guy from Police Academy.
You're all week.
It wasn't quite V'ger, I guess, because it wasn't, I mean, we don't know what was in that cylinder or anything. V'ger was obviously very impressive. The cloud, the layers, the orifices, as Spock just described them. We were behind the second orifice. I think he said something like that. That's how I learned the word orifice, was some Star Trek The Motion Picture. That's why I say that.
He does in that movie. You're right. Okay. You're right. But I didn't think about that probe, but it was supposed to be ancient and it looked old. It was just a cylinder. But with the the Saratoga in the background losing its lights and things like that. Yeah, I mean the whole beginning of the show was pretty good. It's funny when you talk about continuity and special effects. Now I'm getting too much into the movie and I'll deviate back, but you don't go to warp speed and it take any time at all to go around the sun when you're in Earth's atmosphere, right? I mean you're past the sun.
Yeah, going
to warp
in the atmosphere is an odd choice, Kirk.
Yeah, and I still don't understand how the Bird of Prey goes to warp.
It has that fire in the back.
Of its impulse engine.
It's like the Batmobile. Atomic batteries to power, turbines to speed, Roger's ready to move out. That's the Bird of Prey.
Okay.
You're looking for nacelles is your problem, I guess.
I guess it's got guns, it doesn't have engines, and it's got, what looks like a... maybe it's a 2-in-1 engine.
Well,
as we
find out in Star Trek 4, it does have dilithium crystals. So
it certainly does.
I'm not sure where it channels that energy, but yeah.
Okay, hey, we had fun with that. So... So do we dare go to the next one?
Yeah, Star Trek VI. Let's go ahead.
Now, wait a minute. I'm just using my hands here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You missed one, dude.
I'm using the Reliant math of like, oh, we're on the sixth planet. Planets in the solar system, guys. So
yeah. It Star Trek V exploded six months before.
Shift the gravitation orbit.
I guess all we can say about Star Trek V is the... there were a couple of cool shots, I will say. The god thing was kind of odd, but the colors of the Bird of Prey coming over the ridge to save Kirk was kind of cool when he was standing there looking at it. When it shot the god thing, it looked as awful as the rest of the movie.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I watched these all at once, right? I mean, I think Star Trek VI was Star Trek VI is the first movie I remember seeing in the theater. I was very young, but I remember seeing it. So, growing up, I had all the rest of these films on tape, and you just watch them one after another. You don't really think about, they all kind of bleed together for you. So at the time, I didn't really think about, the special effects in this one are obviously a lot worse than the other ones. They're all the Star Trek movies to me. But, when I get older and you, re-examine the films and you watch them through different eyes, you're like, yeah, that's a little rough, guys. That's a little rough. I guess ILM was busy making, I believe, The Last Crusade. Is that why they were tied up and they couldn't do Star Trek V?
I don't know. They're probably making two or three other movies.
I'm not sure who did the special effects on Star Trek V.
Yeah, Bren. He had an interesting name, but he was a commercial maker, is what he was. And,
so what you're saying is the original effects of motion picture before they redid them probably looked a lot like this, huh?
Well, maybe. Maybe it was the same guy, and Shatner didn't know him. I do remember being at a convention up in Maine when Star Trek V was being made, and James Doohan flew out, and people were asking about the special effects because they ask about everything. And, they were talking, they were asking questions like, will there be transwarp drive, right, in Star Trek V? And, things along those lines. And I'll never forget those questions. And
I love the questions the fans ask. Like,
yeah, yeah, will there be transwarp? Well, I was interested too because, that was kind of left out there.
When you get fans and open mic at a convention, it's like a loaded gun, man.
You just want to record them all. Yeah, you just want to record them all. Some of them are, most of them have toned down now. But
no, they are. They are. But you never know what you're going to get. It's always fun. But anyway, that just
you're right about that. So as they, as they were talking about it, I remember that James Doohan just kind of shook his head. So maybe he was watching dailies or something. I don't know exactly what it was, but he did say, it's somebody Bill knows. He was like in a disgruntled. It wasn't ILM. And that's when we first learned that it wasn't going to be ILM. And I was actually thinking, oh, cool. Maybe it's the same guys that did the motion picture and it'll be it'll be up a scale. Because the budget went up for Star Trek V a fair amount.
Can't you tell?
Ugh, boy. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, it's a shame, the view of the Enterprise as they're approaching it with the moon outside, the you know, reflecting off the glass. It was okay. It was done with a rear projector onto a screen so the actors could actually see that as they were approaching the Enterprise, which was kind of neat. And they tried some things to make it work, but they just couldn't pull it off. So it's a shame.
You see, Shatner wanted to redo the special effects back when they're doing the director's editions of Star Trek and the Motion Picture and Star Trek II back, you know, in the early 2000s with these, you know, collector DVD sets. And Paramount told him no. They said, there's no budget. We're not going to do it. Now, would improved special effects save the movie? No. But they could have eased some things over.
It could have helped a lot, I think, if they could have done a couple of things. I mean,
well, if they would have re-edited it, you know, if they would have, like, actually done, like, you know, what they did with the motion picture, because the motion picture, I think everyone will agree, is a far superior version, the director's edition, you know?
Yes.
Even the little things, like when the, you know, you're talking about the reflection that made me think of this, when they're approaching the Enterprise, they add the reflection on the shuttle pod of the Enterprise when Kirk's first seeing her for the first time, you know, in the director's edition. Like, that's a subtle change, but it adds so much to just what it was otherwise a flat shot. So stuff like that across, I think they would all add up around Star Trek V, but at the end of the day, you're still going to get not the realized version that Shatner wanted that got watered down over the course of the production. You know, is he going to add CGI Rockmen? I know Rockmen is like the big, that's the big thing you talk about Star Trek V. Oh, the Rockmen were supposed to be at the end. I don't know if that would have saved the movie, but it would have been cool to see. You know, we've seen the test footage of that one Rockman suit, and it's like, I don't know.
Well, you know, when the team that did, you know, where no man has gone before put a better barrier up than what these guys did, and they used kind of the same formula that they did for the Mutara Nebula. It was all liquid and stuff, but it just didn't come.
It was
out.
Very flat. There wasn't a lot of depth to it.
Yeah,
you know?
It wasn't. And I think if they did a couple of things, if they could have explained how the ship was able to penetrate it when no other ship could.
Well, fear is the illusion, Ken.
Thank you. But if they could have done that a little bit, that would have been cool. You know, upgraded that nebula a bit. The battle scene was just terrible. The warp scene was terrible. I mean, it just, it really did. I can enjoy a bad movie sometimes when it's shot well. But when it's a bad script with so-so acting. You know, and there were scenes in Star Trek V before people get upset with me that I really did enjoy. The campfire scenes and kind of, you know, there were some really cool things that they did, especially with Cybok when he was going through whether or not they were facing their pain. And I didn't love it, but I appreciated it for what it was. Yeah, it was kind of cool the way those scenes kind of were projected in and out. But yeah, I think that. At least if it had quality special effects, it would have been that much more enjoyable, because there were too many things wrong with it to make it a good movie. But if they had done that, it would have been a better movie. Let's put it that way.
That's a good way to put it. I mean, I still think I still like it better than most people. I mean, I rank it above all the Next Generation movies except for First Contact. But it is the weakest of the TOS movies, in my opinion, because it has the heart, you know, it has the heart. But you're right, the special effects, they're to the point of being distracting. I mean, we were nitpicking a few things as fans do in the first four movies here, but none of those things kind of took you out of the story, you know. And you know, so before we get too far here, something I thought about is the transporter effect. Do you have a favorite of the movies?
I have a favorite?
There's not really a consistent one, because the motion picture is like, it's like a tube. And then the outline comes in the tube, and then after that, it's just like light, you know, like it's not really defined effect until Next Generation comes along. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the Star Trek, the ILM versions of it, you know, with the light kind of goes up and comes down, the
horizontal
and,
kind of
I thought those were pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I think that worked well.
That's pretty much what they use 2 through 6, I think, in various forms of that, but maybe the light's
a
different color or something, but it's all the same general shape and all that. So
no, I agree with you.
Something interesting that's not consistent.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was the same. The motion picture was different when you're right, where it had that blue tube of light, and then the image formage, you know, or the imaging, you know, getting badly mutilated in
one scene. Yeah, I know we're going back and forth a little bit talking about this, but yeah, that was a very effective, scary moment. I mean, I saw that movie as a young child, and I was like, oh my God, that really stuck with me, that, you know, guy dying in the, or people dying in the transporter beam there. And you kind of see the vague, like, shape of a person screaming and the sound, you know, it all kind of adds together. It's a very effective scene. So that's, you know, special effects making that scene, really.
It was disturbing. Yeah, you know, it was.
Video and audio, so.
Yeah, yeah, they did it right. Okay, so let's say goodbye to five, and we'll move on to Star Trek VI. So for Star Trek VI, the I thought overall, of course, ILM's back, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing. They pull out the Klingon warship from the original motion picture and from shots that they used again in the Wrath of Khan,
yeah.
And they painted the hull of the ship. Right, and they gave it some scale, and I thought, you know, it looked pretty good. Brandon Che Mutala, our buddy, he really loved the look of Kronos One in the Undiscovered Country, and Lee agreed with him on that, and I did too. I did like the look of that ship, the Enterprise, when it was leaving space dock and when it was married up to Kronos One, it all looked good. I watched the battle scene now, and I watched the movie not that long ago, probably a couple of months ago, and it didn't play as well as I thought. The explosions and everything with the Klingon bird of prey, all of that was fine with the Excelsior coming into the fray, but the warp effects were cheap. The silhouette and the profile of the Enterprise when it was beat up, it just wasn't lit very well. It was too bright.
Kind of flat.
It looked like a model, you know, and it's like, that was the first time I was like, oh, you know, even though it was getting beaten up, it wasn't getting beaten up to the same level it was. It was getting beaten up worse than Star Trek II, but they didn't do it as well. Let's put it that way. That's how I saw it.
You know, they had a much lower budget this time around because Five had underwhelmed at the box office, so I'm sure that was a consideration. You know, nothing really stick out to me as bad.
No, nothing bad. I think they saved a few bucks on the special effects, and it kind of showed, but it wasn't bad. I enjoyed it. And
they saved a lot of money because the bird of prey could fire when it was cloaked. So hey, it's an invisible ship. We don't have to show it.
Yeah, but they did have to show the torpedo leaving it. And
right, that's true.
And, you know, so you are right on that. They did save some money. I think where they made it up was. More on being more creative with the sets, which were just regenerated generation sets that they utilized and put some things in there to
make
it
look tighter. Then look at how they redressed them here in Six, though. Much better than Five. Five, there's like no effort given to redressing. It looks like when Cybox people take over the Enterprise, they're just running down the corridor of the Enterprise D, right? They don't paint the doors, they don't change the lights. I mean, that could be a scene from Next Generation. We look at Star Trek VI, Nick Meyer does his whole submarine thing again, add some pipes, you know,
yep.
Change some color, and you feel you get the same feel you did from Star Trek II, that nautical feeling that he goes for. So I mean,
the only miss was the engineering section.
Yeah, I was just about to say that engineering, it's like there's only so many things you can do. I mean, the engineering section in the motion picture, and then of course the next two movies, where I guess we only see it in Wrath of Khan, we don't see it in Search for Spock because no one is on the ship to be down there running it, but the intermix chamber and the whole thing, it just made so much sense. It looked so elegant. I don't know if they could have put a different light in the tube, you know, and from the Next Generation. I'm not sure how that would have worked. That probably would have just, of course, had to take apart the set, put it back together. That was probably not part of the budget, manpower, or coming up with the technology to do that. But I would have liked some difference because it's like, yeah, there's Scotty just standing next to the engineering warp core, which he has no clue how it works when he finally shows up in Relics, you know, 80 years later, although this is the same warp core you had on the Enterprise A, Scotty. But anyway.
Yeah, that's a good call-out. But hey, they did what they could, and I thought it was pretty good. And Chris Baca said the same thing. He said the battle looks dated. It does. It's not the best it could have been. But, you know, the Enterprise does leave. When the two ships are flying side by side, the Excelsior and the Enterprise, boy, you really get the scale for how big the Excelsior is, and its flyaway, you know, when it takes that starboard flight turn away from the Enterprise, was pretty cool. So
I think the sound design has a lot to do with that too, not just the visuals, because you kind of hear the rumble of the ship, and then, you know, we're talking all about the visuals here, but I think the sound design throughout all these films has been very good, and that sound is 50% of the experience, Ken. So
it is.
That helps just as much to give you that scale of what you're talking about. So
mm-hmm. So let's. let's jump into, and you know, we're going to take a few sips of Earl Grey here because we can. No one can stop us. Go ahead and try. Sorry, Richard, Lee, Amy. He'll forgive us. So, Generations, we're not going to get into the movie. We're going to save that for later. But let's talk about the special effects. From your point of view, Zach, what were some of the things? Because this is where things started to change in how they filmed the movies.
Well, there's two big things that stick out to me in this movie. One is they had to reuse shots from the series. There were a couple of shots that they didn't have in the Enterprise D. They literally had to crop them for, you know, 16:9 ratio and use them because they didn't have those shots. And that's like, ooh, that sticks out.
What shots were those?
When the Enterprise, I believe it's when Picard's doing like his captain's log or something like that. And it's the, you're at the aft, you're looking at the Enterprise from the aft side, you know, it's flying away from you. Right. And so that shot is like from Encounter or Farpoint. They basically cropped it. Because they didn't have, I don't know if they didn't have time to shoot a shot like that, or they just said, oh, we can just use our stock footage. You know, ILM shot it at Image G back in the day. It's high quality stuff. So I know the bigger model was harder to shoot, and that's why they phased it out of the series, but they did have to bring it back out for the film for the saucer separation and all that stuff. So it was just like, come on, guys. Like, that's kind of cheap, you know? But that's a minor thing. The big thing that sticks out to me is they reuse the Bird of Prey explosion from Star Trek VI. It's Star Trek Generations. I talk about this all the time. But it's like one of the most things that makes me the most angry in Star Trek. It's like you cannot take the climax of your last film and use the same shot for the climax of your current film. And that is unforgivable. That is inexcusable. Are you telling me there was not a second camera rolling when they blew up the Bird of Prey model in Star Trek VI? Could we not have that second angle in this film, by the way? It's just, to me, those are my tangents. Those are my grievances.
It's a fair tangent,
with the special
though.
Effects. It's like, come on, this is not... I get that it's the seventh Star Trek movie, but it's the first Next Generation movie, right? You're setting the tone for what you're going to be doing moving forward, and it's like, really, guys? I'm disappointed. Mm-hmm. But all that said, I really liked, if we're talking about, you know, other special effects things, I really like the relighting of the Enterprise-D. The redesign of the bridge was very good. It looked a lot more cinematic. Whenever the Enterprise D bridge was like on low lighting, was on red alert or alternate universe or whatever, and it was darker, looked so much better than the, you know, the Marriott that they Marriott in space, as they always say. So those are some positives.
Well, you know, from the beginning, I thought the scene with the champagne was kind of different, unique. You know, hitting the hull of the Enterprise B. Obviously, they added what they call the jowls to the side of the Excelsior and created the Enterprise B. I'm not really sure why they did that. It didn't look sleeker to me. It looked, you know, I like the design of Excelsior. It took me a while to get used to, but I didn't like what they did to the Enterprise B. But it was well done. The scenes with the ship in the ribbon, that was all CGI, and it still holds up okay. I thought the shot where you know, it takes that damage on the port side to the secondary hull there where Kirk goes missing was very good. That final shot with Harriman and Scotty and Chekhov standing there as the scene dissolves into to the Enterprise on the ocean, I thought was pretty well done. Otherwise, like, yeah, I agree with the heresy of the destruction of the Bird of Prey. I think one other reason why it bothers me is the Enterprise fired aft torpedoes and hit that ship pretty much head on. The Excelsior and the Enterprise in Star Trek VI were pounding it almost from above, right? And it collapsed in on of itself. And it exploded the way you would think it would. So that's why it's the little things like that. Like you see that I see that a lot of the Star Trek fans see. They go, oh, why did you do that? Right now, it was many years after, let's see, Star Trek.
It's only 3 years. Six.
Oh, was it? Just straight because it was 91? And that's right, the movie came out in 94.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, look,
95?
They used to do this stuff like in movies all the time. If you go back and look like the Universal Monster movies, right, they're reusing stock footage because it's like there was no home video, there was nothing. If a movie came out in 1931, we can use those same shots again in 1934, and who cares, right? This is the 90s, it's the era of home video. So this stuff is burned into your brain, you know? And when you have the climax of your previous movie, you cannot cut and paste it in this movie. So anyway, that's... Moving on from that.
I'm with you. You know, the energy ribbon, all that stuff, that was fine. I mean, if I get into the movie, we'll never get out of it, and I don't want to go there. So I'll just say, you know, the special effects in Generations,
You'd be trapped there for 80 years, Ken, unless someone came and got you.
Don't get me going. Yeah. Anyway, so overall, I thought the effects were fine, and it played well.
Supernova was cool.
Supernova was cool. Mm-hmm. The destruction of a space station was good. I mean, it was fine. I thought the effects, they spent good money on it. They upped the game. That's what you're looking for them to do.
The crash saucer section, did you like that?
I did at its time. It's a little dated now. You know, because now we have another movie you kind of compare it to.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. I thought for a long time, I was like, yeah, that was cool. But now I saw how they did it in Beyond. I was like, oh, yeah, that's how it should be done. But
you know, in Beyond, no one would survive that, or very few.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And so they did it well, I thought. And you know, it was tough from a realism point of view because nobody was buckled in anywhere. And I just can't imagine. You know, in space, you often wonder why they're getting bounced around the way they get bounced around. But when you crash land like that and then you come to a sudden stop, which they captured very well, by the way. When the bow of the ship is coming right at the camera and knocking down those trees, mm-hmm. and it stops and then it pulls and then it goes back, you know, when people go flying or whatnot, that to me was like, come on, you know, I mean, you got to know that's coming, you know, and the kids in the bunk beds and things are tipping over. I'm going, all right, it was built for space. I get that.
Glass is breaking.
Yeah. But the effect itself, you know, it was okay. One of the things that I did always like in Generations that I thought they did a nice job with was when Kirk, you know, the greatest captain of all time, up there with Sisko, Picard was on the top of the mountain, mm-hmm. and the shuttle came, and his head married up perfectly to the movement of that shuttle. He follows it going to the right, then down, and then back down to the left. And I remember that from the time I saw it, and I still like smile when I see that today because
really?
I thought that was really well done. You know,
I've never noticed that before. I'll have to check that out next time I watch Generations.
Let's move on here. I know we want to keep it rolling. So if we move into First Contact, which I think you and I are aligned with completely, that this is the best of the Next Generation movies
by
holistically.
Far.
It was funny. I rewatched.
Oh, you know what? It has the best score too, Brandon. But anyway, go on, Ken.
Got that, Brandon? So
just calling people out today. So
you're out. Hey, you know, that's what people like, because then they can speak directly to our comments, right? So so whether it's Tony or Tim or Lee or Chris or any of you guys, come on, fire at will. When the beauty shot of the Enterprise-E the very first time we saw it, I remember in the theaters going, wow. This is a much better looking ship to me than the D, and I know there's a lot of people that like the D, but I liked it because it kind of reminded me more of what we were used to with the old Enterprise, and I rewatched it about a month, maybe 2 months ago, and it didn't work, man. I was like, because it was all CGI.
Well, there was a model. Are you talking about specifically the first shot?
The first shot. For whatever reason, when it's, you know, they made it pretty, you know, they had all these
where it's in front of the Hubble telescope pictures. Yes.
The gaseous anomalies or whatever. It's like, ah. Now, after that, you know, the battle and all that stuff was great. I mean, that still plays beautifully, chasing the Borg through the temporal wake and all that. It was awesome. All those pieces were really, really good. But that very first shot, I was like, oh, it doesn't look that great to me. I don't know why.
I like the E, and I thought it was okay.
And I like the E.
There was no pomp and circumstance to it. It was just, oh, hey, there's the new Enterprise. You know, I may have, you know, when you saw the new Enterprise in the motion picture, it was a big deal. But here, it's like, oh, yeah, there is a new ship. Okay, on with the show. Like, not that we need to spend 10 minutes flying around it, but I mean, is that, I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about it. It's a subjective thing. Like, is that a good introduction? Is that a bad introduction to the ship? You know, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't hurt the movie in any way, but it's just kind of there. You know, it's, oh, there it is, moving on. I mean, I grew up with I am a child of the Next Generation, so I grew up watching the Next Generation. I grew up with the D, and I get what people say, oh, it looks weird, it's ugly, it doesn't translate well on, you know, film for movies, and it's like, okay, but that was kind of my Enterprise growing up, and you just blew it up.
Sure.
to what, sell more toys, I guess? I mean, I know that was part of the studio mandate, you got to kill Kirk, you got to blow up the Enterprise, you know, this, this, and that. The list that Ron Moore and Brandon Braga were handed by the studio. So, you know, they got a new Enterprise, and yeah, it was a good-looking ship. But we just we didn't get to know it very well because it was only in three movies. So
and that's fair. It's fair. It just it came off, it looked more badass. You know, like this thing could fight. You know, The other ship didn't have that appeal to it, both aesthetically and even if you take it to the bridge looked very much like the TOS bridges, and you know, much more functional and sterile. It wasn't You know, it wasn't a bridge made for comfort. You know, you didn't have those reclining ops and con stations anymore. But you know, it kind of that. I think that's one of the reasons why I liked it. To be honest with you, it just reminded me more of what I appreciated. Now, that's not to say I love the Next Generation, and I did get attached to the ship. I liked about the Enterprise D. Maybe, you know, for its design and all that stuff, it was kind of an awkward ship to me. However, it was the flagship of the Federation, and I always believe that the crew of the Enterprise and the Enterprise should always be the best ship in the fleet, and that's how it was portrayed, and I appreciated that. And I think the Enterprise E is similar in that, right? They got a brand new ship. Mm-hmm. It looked cool, but the effects hold up well. That beginning shot, for whatever reason, just didn't come off as good in my rewatch, but the rest of the movie,
the Borg battle, like you mentioned, is excellent. It's probably the best major, you know, fleet battle in Star Trek, in my opinion.
I wanted it to go on too. You know, I mean, I thought
budget, budget.
Believe me, I get that more than anybody else. I understand that you have to be tight, and art thrives on restraint.
Did you like the redesign of the Borg here, like the ship? As well as the actual Borg, as far as special effects go?
Yeah, they look good. I thought they, you know, they had to come up with a device in order to capture the crew and transfer them into Borg so quickly, which I thought was effective. I mean, that was new. The
nanoprobes. Yeah, I mean, you get so used to seeing that stuff on Voyager, you don't really think about it. You're like, oh, that was new for First Contact, the instant assimilation.
That was very new. So, yeah, so...
But was it necessary to make them not the pale skin? Like, do you like the whole, zombie flesh or whatever they did with the Borg?
Yeah, I mean, well, you had a darker set. You had, you know, them redressing the engineering section. I think it all played together. What I mean? They made it seem more cinematic, I would put it. You know, so, you know, could they have left the pale skin and given me my battle shots a little bit longer? I would have been fine with that too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought overall they did a nice job with them. Mm-hmm.
And the irony that you bring up, they're reusing the Defiant engineering set to be the Enterprise E. So how things have come full circle from the Enterprise A using the Enterprise D engine room, right?
You know what? I never put that together until you said that. I didn't realize that. I thought that was a set that was built from scratch because it was pretty cool and it seemed large.
Well, the actual, I mean, I think they expanded the set, but that the centerpiece, the warp core, that is straight up the Defiant engineering.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty neat. Yeah, but overall, I thought the,
good Vulcan movie, ship was great. The Phoenix effects was great. You know, I mean, everything... Yep. No complaints on my end here for okay. First Contact.
So now we get into another movie, Insurrection. And this, it's so tempting to want to talk about the movie.
I know.
So we'll stick to the special effects. The Enterprise, they made some subtle changes to it, I guess.
They add decks every movie, I believe, to the Enterprise E. So.
Yeah, they play with it. They give it some more weaponry and things. It looked fine. This was pretty much, if I remember right, Zach, pretty much an all CGI film.
This one mostly was CGI, and you could tell. I mean, in my opinion, you could tell. Like, I could always tell when it's CGI or model. And it doesn't. I don't revisit Insurrection as much. I couldn't tell you how well it holds up. So, from my memory, it's like, yeah, that's okay, but it doesn't look quite as good as it did in the last movie because of the CGI, in my opinion.
No, it didn't. But they did some very different things, right? They had more, you know, they had the shuttle battles, so to speak.
Yeah, oh, that's true. The shuttle battles were cool. When it was flying on the grass and all that, that was pretty cool.
Right, and, you know, with the dirt hitting the camera when it flew over, I thought that was pretty good. But it did not look as realistic now. I rewatched it. I think I did like a TNG movie rewatch, I want to say in September, somewhere along those lines. And so it wasn't that long ago. But you know, that end scene where it's flying over the collector, and it's the Enterprise is, you know, with the flames behind it and all that stuff. It was cool when they made it, but you're right, you can definitely tell the CGI. And CGI is, I guess, what I'm seeing now, doesn't age as well as the practical effects.
Mm-mm. Nope.
Right? It just doesn't. And that's the risk you take, I guess. So, you know, you can get better shots, better maneuverability. You can get all kinds of things that you can't get from practical effects, or you know, it costs a lot more money to do it. But those older CGI films are struggling to keep up. And that's what I saw looking. And, you know, I watched them all in HD, so I'm sure that had something to do with it, too.
Right.
So, I the effects on the ground with the shots and the those little ships that they were knocking around that were, you know, hitting them with the transporter inhibitors, dehibitizing gizmos, gadget thing.
Speaking of stuff on the planet, you know, Data running around, the invisible guys running around in suits, that was pretty cool. You know,
yeah.
They achieved that. I mean, that's a trick as old as the 30s, right? But they achieved it quite nicely.
Yeah,
and there's something I've always suspected is a missing special effect, though, in Insurrection. It's when Rafo and Picard are in the collector there.
Yeah.
And it's just this blue. Everything is blue.
Yeah.
Like, to me, I'm like, was this supposed to be a blue screen? They were going to put in something?
They were.
Okay, yeah. Was that part of the plan?
That was part of the plan. Yeah, they didn't. It's just amazing.
I mean, that's what
you're absolutely honest. Right. They didn't. So if you look, you know, from certain scenes, when you're looking down, the thing goes forever, right? But uh-huh. when you look side to side, it's like Kirk leaving the Enterprise in Star Trek: The Motion Picture. It's like, hey, that's the studio.
You know, I haven't read A Fade In, the Michael Piller book. Is that where they talk about this, or I don't know. Like, where did you hear that?
I don't know where I heard it. It could have been a Larry Nemechek thing. I don't remember exactly where I heard it, but
I always suspected. I'm like, well, it's blue, and I don't know why else it would be blue unless they were going to, you know, replace it with something else. Which
it didn't align to the other shots that they had in there at all. So, yeah, you're right. No, they were supposed to do more, and it's for some reason they didn't. And I think they've reshot that. There were a couple of different endings, if I remember correctly. I would like to read the Piller book, and I guess it is now a $100 book on how to write with all kinds of notes in it. And I know before it was a PDF, I don't know if people were getting it illegally or not, on the internet that you could read his script. And it was very different from what I understand. So kind of like other movies that I've seen that didn't work out well that had alternative scripts, I would love to read it. I don't know if I want to get a book on how to write, and, you know, I guess it's a hardbound $100.
Well, it's kind of about the whole process, which I find fascinating, but we'll see how much money I get in my stocking this year, and maybe I'll invest in that book.
Hey, you've got, you know, if any of Zach's family is listening to this show, here you go, right?
There you go.
The surprise Christmas gift. He'd probably like that. He'd like the new encyclopedia, all that stuff. So,
yeah.
All right. So let's move on to the final Star Trek Generation movie, Nemesis. And that's another one that Brandon really liked the score on. this movie, actually, the special effects in this film were pretty solid. You can tell the CGI, like we've said before, definitely on the Romulan planet. But I remember that scene being really cool because that was one of the first times that we saw a scale like that where the Romulan Senate was. And you could see the little people moving and all that stuff. I thought that was neat. You know, they did a pretty good job. The scimitar was a very tropish thing, or it wound up being more tropish even after this movie. Mm-hmm. Huge ship that could, you know, 10 times the size, 10 times the power. I thought a pretty decent design, a little over the top maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's not very memorable though.
No.
Right? It's like generic bad guy, bad ship. The Bird of Prey, the D7, these are iconic ships, the Excelsior.
What did you think of the new warbirds?
I liked the old warbirds. I don't know why they had to change them. Like, you know, I'm like McCoy. I don't want they love to change things, right? They look more like birds. I mean, there's that, I guess.
they had wings, yeah.
They had wings. But, you know, I really finally wanted, we never got to see Dietrich's class, or forgive my lack of terminology as far as the warbirds, but there was a D and then there was an X in it. You know, that's the kind of class of warbird that was in Next Generation. And we always wanted to see them do their thing, right? And we never got to see them do their thing. And I was like, oh, the Romulans are going to be a nemesis. Finally, maybe we'll get to see them do their thing. And we never did. We got these new ships and they're okay, but they're not really fighting the Enterprise. They're fighting the Scimitar. So I guess they're more in line with like the Bird of Prey from Balance of Terror for a way callback. You know, it's like if they had built the ship around the decal on the bottom, that's kind of what we're getting here with the warbirds. So
I guess the front of them kind of looks similar to the warbirds we were used to in
that
the series.
Nose, yeah.
Yeah, not quite. And you know what? It's funny you say it's a nose, because when it blows up the invasion fleet heading to Vulcan in Unification, it looked like the ship was blowing its nose, didn't it? Green laser shots coming out the bottom of its nose, blowing. Okay, I digress. Sorry, but I thought the effects in this movie were good. The nebula or whatever they were in,
the Mutara Nebula. Yeah.
Well, it was green, wasn't it? It was different. It was, you know, believable. It looked good aesthetically.
When the saucer crashes into the Scimitar, that's something we had never seen before. An interesting tactic to see that realized. So I mean, that was there's some good stuff in here. I know we're on the record for being a little more critical of a lot of these films we've been talking about. But hey, credit where credit is due. There is some cool stuff in here.
There was the space dock scene when they're rebuilding the Enterprise was pretty good.
Very reminiscent of obviously what we'd seen in the motion picture and dry dock there.
Yeah, but but to a whole new level, right? Because now you could see the worker bees actually doing the work outside the window. Yeah, it was special effects wise. I thought Nemesis was the better of the was much better than Insurrection by far.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, and, I mean, it was cool. It was cool that we got to see the Enterprise E in action in both these movies, because basically, I mean, it shows up at the Borg battle at the very end. Right? It does a little bit. And then it's just orbiting Earth the whole time in First Contact. So we didn't really get to see it do its thing. So it was cool to actually see the ship, you know, joystick and all in its direction. but do its thing, you know? I mean,
Yeah. So the other thing that I remember about Nemesis was kind of the dune buggy battles and all that stuff.
That
didn't work at
just
all.
Just because Patrick Stewart likes driving cars, we gave Picard the Argo.
It just made no sense. It just, you know, technology-wise, from a Star Trek point of view, you're on a sovereign land and you're shooting at each other.
Yeah.
I don't know. But at any rate, we're getting into the movie. But the jump that it makes to get into the shuttle was pretty cool. I mean, it was actiony.
Did you like the weapon? Like, I know we talked about the Senate earlier, but the weapon that turns everyone to stone, basically.
Yeah, and those effects are pretty good.
And then the giant one at the end that, you know, of course, Data shoots. I mean, that was like it kind of makes like a double helix kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So that was cool, I guess, as a doomsday, another doomsday device in one of these films, right? I think you're right, Ken. I'm not sure what the change was. I can only assume the budget was less than Insurrection for Nemesis. So maybe they allocated more to special effects. I'm not sure. But overall, it is a slicker looking film.
I don't know if the budget was less, but they built an entire town on a mountain in Insurrection.
That'll do it.
That cost a fortune. You know, that cost a fortune. So I think it was just where they allocated the funds. It was more towards the land side of it than the space side of it. And this was more of a bottled movie, which, you know, a couple of tweaks here and there and some pacing, we could have made this movie a lot better. But the special effects worked, I thought.
Another film I would love to see the director's edition of, or the extended cut of, because there is like 45 minutes of deleted scenes for Nemesis. So if you went back like to all the raw footage and reassembled it from scratch, I think you would, you know, you could have a better film. Definitely. There is better material there that could be rearranged. But hey, we're not here to talk about the films.
It's not much more what you could edit in. It's more what you could edit out of this one.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think
bye-bye, you know, B4 would be gone. things like that. So
very good.
Things along those lines where it just killed the movie, I thought. But all right. We ready to move into a whole new era?
Let's punch it.
A whole new era. Oh, I like that, Zach. That's pretty good. So in 2009, we were introduced to the rebooted Star Trek. This was a CGI show, but it was brought in with major dollars. Was it $150 million to make this movie? Something like that?
Yes, I believe so. And then those budgets go up for the next two films for you know, the Kelvin timeline movies. But, you know, the money does show on the screen. And a lot of times you hear about movies like they have $200 million budget. That's outrageous. But I think the money is on the screen in all three of these films. And we can talk about them all together because they all kind of, you know, blend together. It's the same stuff. I think, you know, that there are no physical models here for the Enterprise. When we see it, it's CGI. But they shoot it in a way where they can't do stuff that a model couldn't do. And I really appreciate that, you know. We've talked about it many times before with the Kelvin timeline, and that adds to a sense of like, you know what? I know it's CGI, but you're doing it the right way, and it's fooling me, and I'm with you. So
they were painstakingly detailed, too. You know, with the reflections and the light and all that stuff. And I'm not talking about lens flares yet. I'm just talking about, you know, I remember even watching the effects show for Star Trek 09, and they were talking about how when the light reflects off the hull, it's not perfect, right? It's made by humans, they were saying. There will be
imperfections
in the design. And it's like, yeah, I mean, and, you know, we could talk about the design of the Enterprise, and it takes a lot for me to get used to even today. I like it, but I don't love it. But it was well done. The opening shot in the movie was phenomenal. Just absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely. And it was very realistic. And the updated effects with the view screens and what they were able to track, it seemed much more realistic, right?
It's extrapolating where we are now with technology and saying, where would we be in 300 years? Okay, in the 60s, that was what we got. But here, now in the aughts, this is what we get. And, you know, you have, you know, like, I love what you mentioned, the view screen. I love how it's like three dimensional and there's data displays on the side of it. I mean, that's what you would get in a view screen on a, you know, a tactical vessel, you know, a tactical display. That's what it is. It's not just a leisurely window there. It's supposed to be a tactical display, and it gives you information you need. So I really like the updated view screens there. And then also how it's also glass, you know, which is really cool, which leads to some really cool creative shots. You know, once again, talking about special effects wise, and you can see the crew, you know, through the window, and because space is three dimensional and there's no up and down, left or right, they shoot the ship like upside down a lot or from very interesting angles. You don't get to see all three of these films, you know, Abrams and Justin Lin all approach the Enterprise in very unique angles that we had never seen before and that are very creative.
Extraordinarily creative. They did a great job with the effects. A lot of people, hey, the lens failures were distracting. That was probably one effect that was overdone, but I didn't mind some of them, because again, if you look at it as though it was made that you were there or through a documentary lens, it would have been like that, right? You would have had those hues just like you would have would through your own eyes. But yeah, there was everything about this movie I thought was really good. The only thought that I thought was maybe a little bit underdone, I don't know, I'm curious your opinion on that, was the destruction of Vulcan.
Well, you know, thinking about that, we didn't mention the Praxis ring in Star Trek VI when Praxis exploded, which has become an iconic, you know, special effect. I mean, Star Wars ripped it off now for all its special editions. When anything blows up, you get the Praxis effects, what they call it. So no, we did not get anything like that in 09. But I actually like that. I like how the planet kind of crumbled in on itself.
It was imploding.
Yeah, and with that, so it calls for a different effect, you know, than like Krypton exploding in Superman or something like that, right? I liked that. You know, it's something we hadn't seen because it truly was, like you said, imploding. So I thought it was appropriately understated for what they were going for, because it's sucking in all the matter and it sucks the planet into its own little black hole, into nothingness, as the Enterprise warps away. I liked it. It really fit into the rules of what they were trying to do. That was exemplified perfectly with that special effect, in my opinion.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you liked it. I'm not saying I didn't. I guess from my point of view, when it was collapsing in on itself, the effect would have been different. It kind of looked like it was like they did a cutout of a circle and it was swirling inward, and then, you know, boom, it disappears. I guess I was expecting maybe whole hunks, like the planet actually literally turning inside out. You know, that type of a thing.
Yeah.
We're talking semantics, but, you know, for all the money that they spent on things or whatever, I was just kind of like, ooh, you know, that seemed kind of, It just didn't look the way I would have thought it would have. It did its job. It was fine. The scary monsters, the monsters on Delta Vega.
Very J.J. Abrams monsters, yeah.
Yeah, they were fine. Yeah, they did look a little bit like, Cloverfield and all that. But
right, of
course. It worked. The Enterprise looked great in battle with mm-hmm. with the pulse cannon type of approach at the end there.
I prefer phasers. I think I mentioned this before, but I prefer the beams. I mean, that's something mm-hmm. that set Star Trek apart. In my opinion, that is one special effect I wish they would have kept more in traditional Star Trek, because, you know, any sci-fi franchise has little blasters, little, you know, pulse cannons, as you say. But, you know, I'm looking for beams, looking for constant lasers and phasers, man.
Yeah, I guess I took it in my fan mind, right? The fan retconning of things. Well, I'm not retconning, but fan view, fan eyes, I guess, is that when you were taking out a series of missiles, you had to set the phasers to fire that way, and that they would still have the ability to do that. You know, that's all, because it was just short bursts taking out lots of little things, lots of little objects. So,
you know, and we've talked about all these ships so much. You know, I mean, the Narada looks cool. You know, it's mm-hmm. It's a very very distinctive. It's a lot better than the Scimitar, for example. You know, in my opinion, I don't know. I mean, they're both big black ships, I guess. But yep. And then, you know, to follow through the Vengeance, right, of the three of them, I like the Narada the best, because it has the most, like, it's this squid-looking thing with pointy edges. It has a lot of character to it, just in its very design. So of the three in a row big, bad black ships we get, I do like the Narada the best. You know, the Vengeance is, like, it's just a bigger version of the Enterprise, and it's black because it's evil. You know, we talked about that. The Vengeance is black, and it's evil.
USS ticked off.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's that. Those are really the only ships we see. I mean, we see the Klingon ships. We've talked about these ships before, special effects-wise, I think. They all look great, you know?
Keep going, man. Take it right into Beyond. You're on a roll. Sure, man.
They all look great. They all hold up. The Swarm is good. You know, the Franklin is cool. I mean, it's basically an updated NX-01 style design. They kept in the continuity. That's great as well. The Enterprise has these slight modifications throughout the three movies. But ultimately, Ken, I think Star Trek has never been this level, other than the motion picture. The Kelvin Timeline movies are the only ones that are at the cinematic true scope of a motion picture, right? Of a true film, right? Not just a movie, it's a film. But I think we would both agree that as good as these look, I would still prefer practical effects.
I guess you can enhance one with the other. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So if they had a good balance between the two, that would be really neat. If the ships were filmed with practical effects, real models and things, that would be neat. I understand cost, maneuverability, all that other stuff. But you can enhance with CGI its background, what it's dealing with.
Enhancing the model. Enhancing practical effects. Because I always point to the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which is the perfect marriage of practical effects and
CGI.
That's a great example. Mm-hmm. Do as much as you can in camera, and then use CGI to accent or augment or enhance whatever, you know, whatever thesaurus vocabulary you want to use to the surroundings, and make it more fantastical. Because I think everything they could have done with the Enterprise, it could have been a model, but they shot it so well. Like the Enterprise in particular, I'm actually completely cool with it being CGI, because they approach it so well. So for a series of movies that's using exclusively CGI, I mean, I think the Kelvin Timeline is pretty much as good as you can do it. So it's practically CGI, right, Ken?
That's right. I like that. Practically CGI. Maybe we'll use that.
Perhaps we shall. Okay. Perhaps we shall.
All right.
So.
All right, my friend. This was a great topic. I really enjoyed it. And I'll just bookend it with this. We said at the beginning, Star Trek is about substance over style. But when you can get both, it certainly makes it a lot of fun. And I think we talked about where we could have used a little bit more style. but in a lot of cases where we didn't get that style, the substance was there. And then in some cases, like in Star Trek V or Insurrection or others, it just wasn't we didn't get both. But that's okay. This was a fun topic. I really enjoyed it, Zach.
Yeah, me too. And I'm sure we missed lots of things, which people will correct us on the Bible Conference. And please do, because we love your interaction. So please let us know. and then also, hey, don't forget, guys, we have our Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1 Blu-ray giveaway still going on through December 15th. So please go to iTunes, leave us a review, let us know what you think of the show, and you'll be entered to a contest to win a new, unopened Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1 on Blu-ray. So please do that. We'd love to hear from you there. And we'll be announcing those the week of Christmas. So somebody will get a nice Christmas present from us to you. So again, we look forward to all your feedback on this show. Always a fun conversation, talking about the grand scope of Star Trek, as we always do here on Standard Orbit. But the evolution of special effects across the Star Trek films isn't the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. Here's a look at some other topics being discussed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Don't watch any of the extras on the first disc because they're all duplicated over the second disc. So then that way you can just watch them in order and not have to worry about, oh, well, let me skip this one because I watched it on the first disc and do all that.
Wait, to clarify, they have all the special features in column A on one disc and then all the special features of column A plus column B on a second disc?
That is correct.
That makes no sense to me at all.
I know. I was very confused when I sat down to watch it.
Melodic Treks.
Matter? I barely know her. Oh, it's painful. I don't know. You snowing
like,
me?
Just saying Remus and blah, blah. I felt myself falling asleep. I felt like it was my parents were telling me a good night story where you were giving me that track listings there that... like.
Does it still McFly?
That's one of my favorite ones.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Within about 15 seconds, you texted me back, Dr. Giggles, we have to do Dr. Giggles. And my question for you is,
yes,
why did we absolutely have to do Dr. Giggles?
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions, and that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
If you would like to get in touch with us here at Trek.fm, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at Trek.fm, facebook.com/trekfm, and The Babel Conference. Type The Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners. So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, we'd like to thank Renee Roberts, Richard Rutledge, and Aaron Harvey. Thank you so much, always, for your support for both Standard Orbit and the Trek FM network. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701. You can find Richard at rut8972. And you can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at geekfilter. So if you're looking for me on the network, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm always on there, pre-post shows, talking different subjects with all our listeners. And you can also find me on Twitter at Boston, SCPO. That means Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of That Young Superman Show from the early 2000s, and we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything, really. Love to talk to you guys on there. So thanks for listening, everyone. And join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.